An Osho Talk. The great Zen master, Ta Hui, reflections on the transformation of an intellectual to enlightenment. Number 8.
Buddha is the medicine for sentient beings. Once the disease of sentient beings is removed, the medicine has no further use. If you want to attain oneness, just give up both Buddhas and sentient beings at once. An ancient worthy said, "Just perceive nothingness in the midst of things." I formed the repository of thusness with subtle illumination that is neither destroyed nor born. And the repository of thusness is only the illumination of sublime enlightenment shining throughout the whole cosmos. Nevertheless, both are ultimately empty falsehoods. If one abandons the power of actions to grasp the power of the path, then I would say that this person does not understand the skill in means of all the Buddhas in expounding the truth as is appropriate to the occasion. Why? Have you not read how old Shakyamuni said, "If you cling to the truth aspect, you are attached to self, personality, living beings, and life. If you cling to the non-truth aspect, you are attached to self, personality, living beings, and life." Thus it is said, the Buddha only uses provisional terms in guiding sentient beings. As soon as the source of the sickness was pointed out to him by an old adept, Chang Cho, the famous scholar in the old days, understood enough to say, "Trying to eliminate passion aggravates the disease. Rushing towards true suchness is also wrong. There is no obstruction in worldly circumstances according to one's lot. Nirvana and birth and death are equally illusions. Be like the stillness of water, like the clarity of a mirror, so that whether good or bad, beautiful or ugly approach, you don't make the slightest move to avoid them. Then you will truly know that the mindless world of spontaneity is inconceivable."
Hui. In these sutras this evening, comes very close to truth. But even to be close to truth is not to attain it. Even the closeness is a distance. whatever he is saying could have been said by an enlightened being. And then its meaning would be totally different. He is repeating very cleverly statements of ancient enlightened people, but they sound phony. They don't sound alive. It seems something is dead inside them. He does not show that what he is saying is his own experience. There is no authority in it. But we will try to understand, because the statements that he is quoting from others are significant in themselves. Alas, that he himself has not experienced them. And experience makes such a great difference. A blind man can describe all the qualities of light, he can describe all the beauties of a rainbow, but in his description something essential will be missing. And anybody who knows light and knows the colors of a rainbow will immediately feel that the man is blind. Perhaps he has heard about light, but he has not seen it. And I will tell you how different will be the same statement from a man of enlightenment. The first sutra, Buddha is the magician. For sentient beings, once the disease of sentient beings is removed, the magician has no further use. It is perfectly true as far as magician is concerned. But Buddha is not the magician. Buddha is the stage when you are cured, and no magician is needed. Buddha is your innermost nature. A man who knows through experience would have said, meditation is the magician. For sentient beings, once the disease of sentient beings is removed, the magician has no further use. Meditation is no more needed for one who is enlightened. But to use the word Buddha instead of meditation sows tremendous confusion in the mind of the person. He may have heard someone talking about that once the disease is gone, the medicine has no use. That's true. But is Buddha the medicine? Buddha is your absolute health. He is your intrinsic, eternal nature. You cannot throw it. It is you, in your very innermost authentic being. Meditation is a method. And the method is for a particular purpose. When the purpose is fulfilled, the method is not of any use. Do you think I meditate? The disease is gone, and at the same moment, simultaneously, meditation has also disappeared. I have told you before that the word meditation and medicine come from the same root. Medicine is to cure the body, and meditation is to cure the consciousness. But their function is to cure. And once the cure has happened, they become of no use. But to use the word Buddha is absolutely absurd. That's how a man who tries intellectually to understand is bound to commit small mistakes. And he will not be able to figure out where he is committing the mistakes. He is very careful. But carefulness alone is not going to help. Consciousness is needed. If you want to attain oneness, just give up both Buddhas and sentient beings at once. The same mistake continues. It is true, if you want to attain oneness, you have to draw all kinds of duality. The duality between the ignorant and the knowledgeable. The duality between birth and death. All kinds of dualities have to be dropped. But Buddhahood is another name of oneness. There is nothing opposite to Buddha. It is not part of the world of dualities. It is the very transcendence beyond the dualities. Every duality will disappear, then you will know oneness, then you will know your enlightenment, then you will be a Buddha. Buddha has not to be dropped the way other dualities have to be dropped, because it is not part of any duality. Have you ever met anybody who is a non-Buddha? Everybody is a Buddha. Few are asleep, few are awake, but there is not a single sentient being who can be called a non-Buddha. This word Buddha has no opposite to it. Hence, it is exactly of the same meaning as oneness. I formed the repository of thusness with subtle illumination. That is neither destroyed nor born. And the repository of thusness is only the illumination of sublime enlightenment shining throughout the whole cosmos. He is again quoting someone, because this statement is within quotes. And this is the problem of all the intellectuals of the world. They can quote perfectly, but the whole quotation goes against the previous sutras. As they are, if they are right, then this quotation cannot be right. This quotation can be right only with my changes. Instead of Buddha, meditation, and instead of dropping Buddhas and sentient beings to attain oneness, dropping all dualities to attain Buddhahood, because Buddhahood is another name of oneness. If these corrections are done, then this quotation is right. I will read it again so you can understand why I am saying that it can be right only with corrections. In the previous sutras, I have formed the repository of thusness with subtle illumination that is neither destroyed nor born. And the repository of thusness is only the illumination of sublime enlightenment shining throughout the whole cosmos. Now, what is this illumination of sublime enlightenment except Buddhahood? Just a different name. And if even this has to be dropped, then what remains? Dualities have to be dropped, not oneness. birth and death have to be dropped, not life. Life is eternal. It is beyond birth and beyond death. And now he is accepting it. That the subtle illumination, and what is illumination other than the state of Buddhahood? These are different names only. Illumination, enlightenment, awareness, Buddhahood. But he does not seem to understand that they are names of the same experience. This subtle illumination is neither destroyed nor born. There is only one thing that is neither destroyed nor born, and it is the very principle of life. Birth happens in it, death happens in it, thousands of times, but life continues. Birth and death are small incidents in the eternal flow of life energies. Birth is not the beginning and death is not the end. Just small incidents in the eternity of life and existence. Nevertheless, both are ultimately empty falsehoods. Now this is his own statement, without quotation marks. And immediately he falls into his intellectual state. Nevertheless, both are ultimately empty falsehoods. If one abandons the power of actions to grasp the power of the path, then I would say that this person does not understand the skill and means of all the Buddhas in expounding the truth as it is. To say that both are ultimately empty falsehoods means the ignorant people are false, and the awakened people are also false. Ignorance is false, and illumination is also false. Then what remains that you can call as true? And if there is nothing as true, there is no criterion to call anything false. False is possible only if there is something which is not false. Unless the not false is there, the false cannot exist. And he is saying both are false. The not false and the false. The true and the untrue. Both are false. And he is thinking that he is making a great statement. He is simply showing his utter ignorance. And all intellectuals are ignorant people. With great borrowed knowledge, with beautiful birth, with great philosophical jargon, but no understanding or experience of truth. Have you not read how old Shakyamuni said, if you cling to the truth aspect, you are attached to self, personality, living beings, and life. If you cling to the non-truth aspect, you are attached to self, personality, living beings, and life. Thus it is said, the Buddha only uses provisional terms in guiding sentient beings. It is a little subtle, but not impossible to understand. He is quoting Gautam Buddha. But in the quotation, there is something missing. If you cling to the truth aspect, if you cling to any aspect, true or false, you cling to the power. And the part is never the whole. And the part becomes the barrier to attain the whole. So Buddha is right when he says, don't cling to the truth aspect. And don't get attached to it. He also says, don't cling to the non-truth aspect. But remember the word aspect, which Tahui has forgotten. He is not saying that truth and untruth both have to be dropped. If truth and untruth both have to be dropped, then what remains? What you are going to call it? He is saying a totally different thing, and Tahui misunderstands naturally, because an intellectual cannot do more than that. He is saying, don't cling to any aspect, whether it is the aspect of truth or the aspect of non-truth. Just don't cling. His insistence is for not clinging, non-attachment, because every attachment, every clinging will keep you in a bondage, will keep you in ignorance. Even if you feel that this is true, don't cling. The question is not truth or untruth. The question is of clinging. His emphasis is on non-clinging. Don't cling even to the truth. That does not mean that truth has to be abandoned. It simply means clinging has to be abandoned. Clinging makes everything a bondage and imprisonment. Non-clinging brings freedom to you. And truth can be alive only in absolute freedom. You cannot keep truth in bondage, in any kind of imprisonment. You cannot grasp truth, because truth is almost like the open sky. You can have it on your open hand. The whole sky is yours. All the stars are yours. But don't try to make a fist. The moment you make a fist, the whole sky has slipped out of your hand. His insistence is not to be attached, certainly not to be attached to untruth, which is simple to understand. That's why he is making it clear that even if you are attached to truth, attachment is a poison. It will kill even the truth itself. So remain aloof, unattached, just a witness. Then the whole truth is available to you. And the whole untruth simply disappears. It has never been there. It was your own projection. You had created it. But Tahui thinks that Buddha is saying truth and non-truth both have to be dropped. That certainly Buddha has never said, and he is not saying even in this statement. And to support his idea, he again says, thus it is said, the Buddha only uses provisional terms in guiding sentient beings. It is true. Not for any special reason that Buddha uses provisional terms, arbitrary terms. There are no possibilities to bring the truth into knowledge, into words, into language. So only provisional, approximate, as close as possible to the truth. But it is provisional. Once you have reached the realm of truth, you will have to abandon all those terms and words and theories and doctrines and scriptures. They have helped you. When the finger points to the moon, certainly the finger is helping you. But the finger is not the moon. And when you have seen the moon, the finger is of no use. There is no need to cling to the finger. There is no need to worship the finger, because it has shown you the moon. that will be simply foolishness. The finger pointing to the moon is just like the arrows on the milestones, which show you how far you are from the place you are going, and how far you have come from the place you are coming. But you never worship those arrows. You never even say to them, "Thank you, sir." They are provisional means, and they are of great utility. All the words used by enlightened people are of great utility, but they don't have the essential truth in them. They are only arrows pointing towards it. But without them, perhaps you may never look at the moon. If the Buddhas have not been insistent, continuously emphasizing that you are asleep, wake up. If they were not making all kinds of devices to wake you up, perhaps you may never wake up. Although once you are awake, you don't worship the alarm clock. Alarm clock has been of great utility. It has awakened you. But a thing of utility is not a thing to which you have to be grateful. As soon as the source of the sickness was pointed out to him by an old adept, Chang Cho, the famous scholar in the old days, understood enough to say, now to use for Chang Cho the word scholar is not right. He is not a scholar. Ta Hui is a scholar. Chang Cho is a Buddha. He has come to know the reality, and we can see in his statement the fire the illumination, the celebration. And a subtle presence of truth. Even though you may not have experienced it, but if you can be just for a moment silent and listen to what Chang Cho says, you can see the difference between the words of a scholar and the words of a man of enlightenment. These are the words of Chang Cho, trying to eliminate passion aggravates the disease. I have been for years being condemned because I have been saying, don't repress anything that is natural to you. That has become against me a worldwide antagonism in the minds of the priests of all the religions without exception. They think that I am supporting people's biological instincts. What I am doing is simply what Chan Cho is saying, trying to eliminate passion aggravates the disease. All the people who have been teaching celibacy, anti-life attitudes, controlling your sex, controlling your hunger, controlling everything that nature requires you to fulfill, it has not helped anybody. It has only created perverted people, sick people, psychologically, spiritually, physically, all kinds of perversions have been created. This man, Chan Cho, must have been a man of absolute enlightenment, because thousands of years before, he is saying exactly what even today the world is not willing to understand. Trying to eliminate passion aggravates the disease. Rushing towards true suchness is also wrong. Because you cannot desire suchness. Rushing is a desire. You want to reach quickly to the state of suchness where you can relax, rest, and accept whatsoever life brings to you. It is not a question of rushing towards some place. It is simply a question to relax right now. It is not a desire and it is not a goal. It is not a destination that you have to reach. It is a simple understanding, and you are already wherever you are, capable to live the beautiful experience of suchness. Chan Cho is right when he says rushing towards true suchness is also wrong, because you cannot make a goal of it. You cannot make a destination of it. It cannot be an object of your desire and your will. It is simply a pure understanding, a silent understanding that whatsoever life brings to you, rejoice in it. No complaint, no grudge, no asking for more. Just in a silent moment, release the feeling, then this very moment suchness is yours. There is nowhere else to go. Suchness is your nature. There is no obstruction in worldly circumstances. According to one's lot, when I started telling to the monks, Hindu monks, Jaina monks, Christian monks, that renouncing the world is simply cowardliness. It does not sow your understanding, it simply sows your fear. It is escapist. There is no obstruction in worldly circumstances. If you are living in suchness and let go, there is nothing in the world which can disturb you. There is no obstruction. Because you are capable to accept everything, even the obstruction. You will absorb it without any complaint. You will simply say, such is my lot. Such is my destiny. You will not ask that it should have been otherwise. So why escape from the world? Escaping means that you wanted a different kind of place where you can be at ease, but you can never be at ease anywhere. I have heard about a man who had a very angry nature. And he was very quick in reacting. He will not even think for a single moment what he is doing, and he will repent for it for his whole life. Because he became a nuisance in the whole town, he asked a monk who was visiting the town that, what should I do? Everybody seems to be boycotting me. And I understand that I am temperamental and I get angry very quickly. It comes with such force that I don't have any time to think about. And I act according to my anger. And then I repent that I should not have said that, I should not have done that. But now I have made the whole town my enemy. The monk said, it is not your fault. This world never allows anybody to live peacefully, silently, prayerfully, one has to renounce it. It is a world full of sins and full of sinners. What do you think? All great religious founders have renounced the world. Were they fools? Renounce this world. Come along with me. The logic was clear. It is very easy to throw the responsibility on other people's shoulders. The world is wrong. You are perfectly right. But what can you do if the whole world is wrong and it drives you into wrong paths, and from everywhere the incentive is to do the wrong? And the monk convinced him that just come with me, I am going to the Himalayas, live silently in a cave, nobody will provoke you, and the anger will disappear. How can you be angry when there is nobody else except you? It was so convincing and so ego-fulfilling that I was not wrong. It is really the whole world is wrong. That's why all great religious teachers renounced it, went into seclusion, into isolation. If they could not cope with this world, I'm a small man. How can I cope with it? So he renounced the world, went into the forest. Sitting under a tree, he was feeling very good that this is true. Those who have renounced the world have known eternal peace, and just at that moment, a crow pissed over him. You can renounce the world, but there are monk crows also who have renounced the world and they live in the mountains. Immediately he jumped up, became very angry, forgot all about renunciation, started throwing rocks at the crow, and his master who has brought him, he came out of his cave, what is the matter? And he became angry at the master, he says, you are the matter. You had told me renounce the world and there will be no anger, and I am sitting here silently doing nothing. No provocation from my side, and a crow comes and pissed over me. Master who has brought him thought that he has brought in very dangerous fellow. He may get angry with him any moment for any reason. He said, it is better, forgive me that I suggested you the idea of renouncing. You go back to the world. He said, I cannot go back to the world. I have suffered there enough, and I have suffered here. I am going to commit suicide. The The master said, it is up to you. But I am not suggesting it, because I don't want to take the responsibility. And the man left. Just nearby there was a village, and he collected wood for his funeral pyre, just on the bank of the river, and the village people gathered out of curiosity. What is going on? What are you doing? He said, I am going to commit suicide. I am going to burn these logs of wood and jump into it alive. Enough is enough. I have seen the world, I have seen renunciation. Now only thing is left is to see whether in death people can get peace or not. The villager said, your idea perhaps is right, but do one thing. Don't make your funeral pyre here. Because when you will be burning, we poor people live here. It will sting. And the smoke will come to our huts. Can't you go somewhere else? Now he was really angry. He said, this is a strange world. They don't let you live. They don't let you die. I cannot even choose the place for my death. If you start thinking in terms that others are responsible, that the world is the problem, other people are the problem, then you are looking from a very wrong perspective. Chang Cho's perspective is absolutely right when he says, there is no obstruction in worldly circumstances according to one's lot. Nirvana and birth and death are all equally illusory. What he is saying, that the people think that if they can achieve nirvana, then there will be no birth, no death, no misery, no problem. Nirvana, according to their mind, is just a golden paradise. But nirvana conceived by the ignorant people cannot be the true nirvana. Hence he has put nirvana into inverted commas. He does not mean the real state of nirvana. He means the conception of nirvana according to ignorant people. Because of their ignorance, they will think about nirvana also. It cannot be the true nirvana. Their nirvana, their birth and death are all equally illusions. And when they have gone beyond all illusions, they will find the space which Buddha calls nirvana. That will not be the same as they were thinking about it. It used to happen almost every day in Gautam Buddha's life, because he was the first man to use a negative term for the ultimate state. In India, Jainas use for the ultimate state the word Kaivalya. It means to be absolutely alone in your pure consciousness. It is a concept of freedom. The Hindus have the word moksha, which actually means absolute freedom. These are positive terms. Buddha perhaps is the only man in the whole history who uses for the ultimate state a word which is negative. Nirvana means nothingness, emptiness. As a literary word, it means blowing off the candle. When you blow off the candle, what remains? Just darkness. Darkness people want to attain to eternal light, not to eternal darkness. People want to be part of a paradise with all the comforts and luxuries that they are missing here. They don't want to enter into a state of emptiness. People want to become gods. They don't want to become just pure nothingness. So every day people were asking Gautam Buddha that if you go on using this word nirvana, nobody is going to follow you. Because who wants emptiness? Who wants nothingness? Who wants eternal darkness? Buddha said, what you want is out of your ignorance. It is out of your unawareness that the desire is coming. So your paradise, your heaven, your moksha are nothing but projections of your ignorance. What I am saying, is simply to negate your projections. I am saying by emptiness, all that you can conceive will not be there. And what will be there, you cannot conceive, neither I can speak about it. I am saying whatever you think are comforts, luxuries, joys, happiness will not be there. And what will be there, you don't have any way even to dream about it. Hence I am using the word nothingness. It is just to negate you. I am not talking about a negative state. I am talking about a very positive state, but that positive state is beyond expression, beyond words. So the only way is to negate you. And if you can understand that you, your mind, yourself, your personality, all will be gone. If you can accept this tremendous idea of entering into an absolutely unknowable world, then only you can taste something of meditation. And finally you can taste what I call nirvana, enlightenment, illumination. He was immensely courageous to use the word nirvana, because people want their desires to be fulfilled. They want consolations. They want opium. They want beautiful opportunities. Then they are ready to do fasting. They are ready to do austerities. They are ready to do any kind of a stupid thing you ask them, in the hope that it is only a question of few days, and after that, eternal. Carnival, circus, movies, love affairs. Deep down in their unconscious, these are the projections. Buddha is cutting their projections in a single blow of his sword. He says, nothing of all this nonsense. You will be attaining to eternal peace and silence and serenity, which can be very closely expressed as emptiness, as nothingness, as blowing off the candle, as nirvana. And I can understand that he was right. People should not be supported in their illusions. They have lived millions of lives in their illusions. And religions go on supporting and nursing their illusions. That you will be getting this, you will be getting that. Just the same desires that you are not being able to fulfill here, you will be able to fulfill there in the ultimate stage. This is a very dangerous game that priests are playing with the whole humanity. The greatest deception, the greatest cheating, the ugliest profession is those of the priests. Buddha is very much against the priests. He is very much against all those people who are trying to persuade you. I am reminded one day I was going to the university and a beautiful woman waved to stop my car. So I stopped the car, she came close to me and she gave a beautiful leaflet. On top of the leaflet there was a very beautiful house by the side of a beach and the ocean, and on the other side a thick pine forest. And the pamphlet on this picture said, "Do you want to have such a house?" I said, "Is there such a house available in this city?" So I looked inside. I thought perhaps it is just for sale or something. So I wanted to look. I would have loved to have that house. The house was really great. And the situation was fabulous. And at the back I looked and it said that if you follow Jesus Christ, then in paradise this house will be allotted to you. I said, but this is insult the whole history of religions. They are telling you this you will get, that you will get. Buddha is the only man who says you won't get a thing. All that you have will be taken away. He does not even allow you as a self. You will be just a consciousness without any idea of I. In the language he used to speak, Pali, Atta means the self. Just as in Sanskrit, Atma means the self. The Supreme Self. Atta is the Supreme Self. And Buddha used the word Anatta, no self. He has used all the negatives and yet the man must have been of tremendous charisma that he persuaded people to lose everything, to drop everything and to enter into eternal nothingness. And the reason why he could persuade people is in his silence, in his blissfulness, in his grace. And people have felt that if this man has entered into nothingness, and out of nothingness so much flowering, and so much fragrance, then there is no need to be worried. This nothingness seems to be better than all our conceptions and dreams. your nirvana is not the nirvana of Gautam Buddha. Chancho is certainly a man of enlightenment. His statement is so clear. Three things he is saying. One, don't try to eliminate passion, because that will aggravate the disease. This is 2000 years before Sigmund Freud. Rushing towards true suchness is also wrong. This is against all religions who want you to be greedy for life after death. For a heaven where you will be rewarded, where your virtues will be rewarded. And there seems to be no criterion how the virtues will be rewarded. I have heard Hindu saints speaking that if you donate 1 rupee here to a saint, of course, to a saint, and there is no other saint than himself in the vicinity, you will get 1 crore rupees in heaven as a reward. It seems to be a kind of lottery, just for 1 rupee. And it is worth risking. Just 1 rupee. It is better to keep a ready-made account there when you reach millions of rupees in your account than enjoy all the luxuries that you could not manage on that. But this is written in Hindu scriptures, that 1 million times more, whatever virtue you gain, it becomes 1 million times more in heaven. This is simply exploiting people's desires, people's minds. Gautam Buddha perhaps is the only great teacher who has not exploited anybody. Tahui, although goes on quoting from great enlightened people, but he does not seem to understand that scholarship and enlightenment are not one. There are so many scholars, you can get them 1 rupee a dozen. They are all around. All the universities are full. All the churches are full. All the synagogues are full. Great rabbis, great pandits, great bishops, cardinals, but they are all scholars. They have studied much. They have gained much knowledge. but they have not gained much being. And wisdom belongs to those whose being expands to its ultimate limits. But it is good to see how an intellectual person a genius can go on committing mistakes. What to say about ordinary people? If they commit mistakes, they have to be forgiven. Even geniuses go on committing mistakes. Perhaps the basic problem with intellectuals is that they cannot conceive anything greater and better than intelligence. And meditation is certainly that which goes far above than intelligence can even conceive. In the whole world, there are so many learned people. But these learned people are not interested in meditation. Because they think learning is enough. Learn more. And there is so much to learn. And every year, knowledge goes on growing so fast that to keep pace with it has become almost impossible. Who has time for meditation? I have been in this country in contact with so many learned people, and I have asked them that after all your learnings, has not the idea of meditation happened to you? They said, but why it should happen to us? There is nothing better than intelligence. It hurts them, their ego is wounded to hear that there is something greater than meditation. An incident happened. I was a student. But I used to go to conferences and to places to speak on different subjects. There was a meeting on the birthday of Nanak, the founder of Sikhism. And the president of the meeting was the Chief Justice of Madhya Pradesh High Court. And I was the speaker. I was just a student. But this man, whose name was Ganesh Bhatt, was a rare man. I have never come across another man of his quality. He was the Chief Justice, and I was only a postgraduate student. after I spoke, he simply declared to the assembly of almost 10,000 Sikhs that now there is nothing more to be said. At least I cannot say anything better than has been said by this young man. So I will not deliver the presidential address, because that may spoil what he has said to you. I would rather like you to go home with what he has said silently, pondering and meditating over it. The Sikhs were surprised. Everybody was surprised. And as I was stepping down the podium, the Chief Justice Ganesh Bhatt touched my feet. I said, "What are you doing? You are of the age of my father. You are a learned man. You are a Brahmin." He said, "Nothing matters, neither my being Brahmin, nor my age, nor my prestige, nor my being the Chief Justice. What matters is that whatever you have said has come from the deepest being. It was unexpected, because I have been presiding on many meetings and I have been listening to many learned people. But all that they say is within quotation marks. For the first time I have heard a man who speaks directly without any quotation marks, who speaks on his own authority." So don't prevent me. I am feeling grateful by touching your feet. The judges had come because the Chief Justice was presiding the meeting. The advocates of the High Court had come because the Chief Justice was there. They were all shocked. But Ganesh Bhatt became a regular visitor to my house. It became almost a regular routine that his car will be standing in front of my house. People started coming to me whose cases were in the High Court. I said, "I cannot help you." He said, "Just a word from you and he will not do anything against it." I said, "I cannot do any such thing. Here he comes with such respect towards me that I cannot bring such trivia it became a problem. I had to keep a servant in front of my house to return these people. Otherwise, everybody was entering in the house asking that I am in much trouble. And just a little support from you will take me out of the trouble. After he retired from the Chief Justiceship, he became the Vice Chancellor of Sagar University. By that time, I had become a professor in Jabalpur University. And I had gone to Sagar to speak in a public conference. An all religions conference. And he heard that I have come, so he invited me to the university, where now he was the vice chancellor. Once in that university, I had been a student. And because the vice chancellor has called the meeting, all the professors and all the students, everybody was present. And I was worried about only thing that he may do the same act again. And my professors were there who had taught me. And thousands of students were there who had been also students, junior to me, and he did his act. I went on the podium, he stood, touched my feet, and said to the audience that to be learned is one thing, and to know on your own, face to face, is a totally different thing. And in my long life, I have been on big posts, and I have come across so many learned people. That I can say it with absolute confidence that learning brings no transformation to their being. And the transformation to being comes through some other door, not through the doors of mind. It was a great shock. Many of them were my teachers. Many of them were students who knew me when I was a student in that university, and their vice chancellor touching my feet. My old professors gathered when I came down after speaking that this is a strange phenomenon. We have never expected. I said, I have been studying under you. But you have never looked in me. You have never looked into my eyes. You have never thought about my questions, what I have been asking. You simply thought of one thing, that I am just creating trouble for you, because you had no answer for it. And you were not courageous to say that I don't know. Intellectuals are very weak about one point. They cannot say, I don't know. Only an enlightened being can say, I don't know. His innocence and his enlightenment are synonymous. Thank you.